welcome to the 116th JBST.com Smartcast, released for midsummer 2013. This is the multi-sport podcast for triathletes, duathletes, sportive riders, road racers, time trialists, runners, mountain bikers, and fitness enthusiasts.
Whatever your distance or whatever your event, this podcast aims to make you smarter and faster.
Thank you for downloading this 116th episode. I'm Coach Joe Beer, and I'm joined once again, you can't wave on air, by South Fork Racing's Martin Crocker. Or should we, South Fork Executive Retail Manager, is that right?
Yes, that sounds brilliant.
Yeah, okay.
Can I have a name badge?
Talk to your boss.
Exactly.
Talk to your boss. Right, how are you?
Very well, yourself?
I'm good. It's midsummer, as you can tell outside tonight.
Well, we've been pretty lucky up to now, I must admit. So, but unfortunately, the wind and the rain is here. But like I've been told, at least it's warm rain.
This is warm rain. Just in time for the Wimbledon 70.3.
That's right.
Race that is probably in a straight line. How far would it be from here?
I reckon 28 miles.
Nah, more than that.
Reckon?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going for 28.
Okay. Okay.
No, it is more than that, yeah.
Okay.
35.
I'm going to say 40. We'll find that out.
What about that?
Okay, so 50 episodes on iTunes and also on the website, depending on which way you listen to this podcast. Ratings and reviews. There is a new rating coming via iTunes. And Martin, over to you to read that one.
This is titled JBST Golden McNuggets. So we have 5 stars on this one by Toby Britt. It says, "Hi Joe and Crocker, last month podcast legend. More information does not mean more informed. Confucius Crocker, awesome. I want that as a t-shirt." Yeah, we should look into that.
Yes, Confucius.
I forgot about that as well.
Confucius Crocker t-shirts. I could see that being, you know, people just wanting to wear a Confucius Crocker, one of your legendary nuggets of just genius.
Yeah, but I don't think it's ever going to live down the, what was it, 9-year-olds?
It wasn't even nine.
Oh, was it not?
No.
I can't remember what it was. I was like, untrained 6-year-olds or something. Oh, good God.
Yes. Anyway. So just to remind you, there are podcasts. 114 is Nick Craig interview done in Mallorca. 108 is Christine O'Hara from Rota. I think that was done over Skype. And way back, number 100 was Mike and Andy Rayler. I'm going to try and get a few podcast interviews done in the next month or so. But if you haven't heard those, go and have a listen. Because I think you'll find that there's some you know, good bits in there. I think we should have an interview of you, to be honest, Crocker.
Me?
Anyway, here's a tweet response to the podcast. Over to you once again, Martin, to read that one.
This is from Ashley James. Is that health then? What an unusual read. Ashley? This might be your surname. Sorry, but it's AJ Health or at AJ Health. Coach Joe Beer, you and Crocker crack me up. Been listening to your podcast on the tube and getting some odd looks when I start laughing. So, well, if it brightens your day or sours your day, then I do apologise. But yeah, strange looks aren't probably the worst thing you could get on the tube, to be honest.
No. No. Right, just a quick, I'm going to give a quick, excuse me, congratulations to Scott Needley, who won the Middle Distance British Championship at the weekend.
Yeah, I saw this.
So, well done, sir. He's off to Canada, so I'm going to try and get a Skype interview while he's in Canada training. He's training as a, you know, full-timer for a few weeks, but he's actually works, so it's pretty impressive that he won the national championship and he's not pro. He has been, but now he works, and he won the national championship. Came down to, as a great link through JBST.com, there's a link to his blog, and he talks about the race and how it came down to being a real big push to the line sprint with this other guy, that it just came down to, right, who's got the beans now, sort That's of thing.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
it was really, really interesting to read what he was thinking and what he was doing. It's very, you know, warts and all, it's good.
I think that's interesting with Scott. Was pro, now's working, you know, and doing so well. I think that's quite a nice advertisement, I think, for a lot of guys that listen to the podcast that do have heavy jobs and training sessions or training schedules and family life. So, you know.
And he's still doing it. I'm not going to read all these various things on air, but if you look at the sort of things that we've been discussing on email, you know, the sort of supplements that he's doing, the type of training, you know, surges, these sort of things that technology didn't use before. Do you know what I mean? All of it is, you know, documented on email, and he's still putting in, you know, he's putting in stuff whereby, yeah, he does.
What Joe's doing at the minute, effectively, is he's pointing out a list of stuff he must have written down having a chat with Scott to the different sections of his training, effectively.
And supplements and
how he got on, yeah.
Bits of kit on his bike and things he has to do and stuff. And what you realise is that's what most people are doing, is they're just ironing out the little bits. And if you've been pro, then you must have a certain amount of... You know, people aren't pro because they train 30 hours.
Yeah,
people are pro because they are good and they train 30 hours.
Yeah.
We've all gone on a training camp and done 30 hours, and it don't make you a pro, it makes you knackered. And even if you've built up to it, it doesn't make you pro.
But you can live like them, though, can't you?
Yes.
That's the good thing about it, for that week where you just think, oh, I could do this.
But it is that attention to detail. So it is that you know, he did things that he would do if he was professional. He made sure that, you know, he did do some hard training. But probably more so, and it may come down to a lot of athletes now, with times being hard and companies watching their bottom line, is that it's better to be racing and to still, you know, have money coming in than to be racing and being stressed about the fact that you've got to make a top five to get some money to cover your travel back home.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of thing. And there are quite a lot of athletes that live at that level. And there's the, you know, there's the big hitters that have got lots of money, but they've almost got to a point where they've got lots of money, therefore they can afford to do anything. And because they can afford to do anything, they get slightly higher performances. But it is interesting that, you know, having gone to full-time work, certainly over half distance, he's rapid, and how that will translate up to... up to Ironman distance.
The full distance.
Yeah.
Well, we shall keep an eye on it.
We will. We will. Did you see, you may know, I don't know whether you know, the Rotor Power Cranks, they've released software where you can watch it basically on your PC screen. So you can watch the details of the cranks. A lot more data clearly you can get on a PC screen than you can on a little Garmin.
Yeah. Yeah.
All
right.
And there's power.rotorbike.com/downloads, you can get this bit of software. I think you still need like a dongle in your computer to talk to the Ant Plus Garmin.
Yeah.
And supposedly there are 500 and 800 Garmin firmware upgrades as well.
Oh, right.
But you can watch this stuff. You can't do it on a Mac, but you can on a PC. Watch more of the sort of things that are going on in your pedal stroke and so on. And that came out the other day. And I found this the other day from 2012. Mark Cavendish saying, this was in a tweet that he tweeted at 9:27 p.m. on the 13th of January 2012. And it says, doesn't matter how often it happens, taking a pee the day after drinking beetroot juice will always freak you out.
I saw this, yeah.
Hashtag pissing rainbows. But, you know, there we go. People are talking about beetroot juice as a, you know, as a concept, nitrate loading. There's even more up-to-date research that I've got and that I've heard is coming down on the grapevine even more. But it's been known about, you know, that was over, you know, if that's January 2012, that's almost 18 months ago.
Yeah, well, I'm chatting to the guys that we race with in the mountain bike circles, there's a lot of old heads there racing. And some of these guys were back in 2010, I think, were managing to get hold of this stuff. Beetroot juice, and as from a retail point of view, now we sell loads of it, absolute masses of it. So, you know, whether it be kind of the liters or the little stamina shots that you can get. We seem to sell quite a few of it.
And it is a, you know, it is a solid science. I think there'll still be a bit like the early days of creatine. Once something was found, it's like, okay, we're onto something. And then people go off in various groups and subgroups and scenarios. They go and look at what's going on and say, okay, how do we optimize it? How do we, you know, can we get even greater effect? Are there people that don't respond, and therefore we can sift out people that aren't responding, therefore see how well some people are specifically responding? Because when you take a group of people and you look at the mean, obviously that can dilute some people's really high responses, and it can also mean that some people never really show up a positive. But it's certainly fairly rock solid.
Yeah. I mean, we're probably a group of five that I know, five guys that we work with or that race for us. And five of those guys take it and have got benefits from it.
Yeah.
They're noticeable benefits. So.
Yeah. And it's not, you know, it's not that sometimes there is a placebo effect with things and people knock the placebo effect. But it's like, no, if you believe in something, then that's already got you doing self-belief.
That's it.
And
yeah,
most of the time, what I see when I coach athletes or hear of athletes that talk to athletes is that a lot of people can be their own worst enemy, is that they don't believe in what they're doing, and therefore when it comes to crunch time they'll be the first one to throw the towel in. Whereas if you believe in something, and also there's a mechanism, and there's a, you know, there's enough research to say, look, this isn't pie in the sky, this isn't just one paper from a beetroot manufacturer.
That's right, yeah.
They've been done at various locations in the UK and in Europe, and there's been other studies that have gone elsewhere, and sometimes it doesn't show up. There was an example of 50 mile time trial performance in it, and I think it's probably really difficult to measure 50 mile time trial performance that's rarely used as a measure of performance. Normally they would do a set amount of work for 90 minutes and then have a time trial of a set amount of energy, and that would be able to show or not show effects. 50 miles, there's too much variability in that test. So there are some that come out, but have you seen that doesn't work? No, that's just one scenario where probably either it isn't the right sport, and in the cycling's case it's not the right sport, it's that it just isn't the right scenario to measure it. And there are people that I've spoken to, mountain bikers, road racers, time trialists, triathletes. I don't know about
welcome
runners.
To the 116th Joe Beefy.
Yeah, but I don't know about runners, but in all of those different spheres, there's people saying, yeah, this stuff's pretty good, isn't it? I think I'm noticing effect because, wow, there's something going on. And if it's a coincidence that it's the beetroot, that's an amazing coincidence. But if they're taking the right amount, no, it's not a coincidence. It is working. Yeah, but I think people become, you know, let's face it, the adverts on telly about how many percent better your skin's going to look or rubbish like that. People get really switched off from being sold something that sort of, trying to sell something else. It's like, well, no, you and me don't benefit from beetroot juice. Somebody might have beetroots in their garden. If you want to make it, do it that way. But it has to be at a high enough nitrate level to be of benefit.
Yeah.
But if you take it, it's having effects. And if it has an effect, and that's a pretty simple thing for you to do, drink, you know, a pint of beetroot juice with your supper or however you do it, I love it. I have to say, I love it.
Vile.
Yeah, and that's it. One person said, I absolutely hate it. Okay, we'll cross that off the list. You have to do something else instead. You know, you can have celeriac, you can have rocket, you can have, not a rocket, but rocket lettuce. There's loads of different things that are still on the high nitrate category.
Yeah.
That if you eat enough salads and stuff, you may be getting a reasonable amount of nitrate, but it's something about beetroot juice. It's to take on board the amount you need, it's a much more tolerable level.
Because I don't think people understand about the loading phase of it either.
No.
Because we get a lot of runners in saying, oh, your stamina shots, have you got them? So yeah, he said, just normally take one before the event. I said, well, you do realise you can have a 6-day loading cycle, that'll improve. And he, one of the guys was like that, oh, really? Well, doesn't that work out quite expensive?
I said, sorry, you've hit the nail on the head. Unfortunately, runners are in a sport that isn't expensive.
Yes.
Really, in the grand scheme of things.
When you compare it.
You know, you compare it to buying a tyre. Your tyre goes, you go, okay, that's a 50 quid tyre.
Yeah.
You know, that might be a pair of running shoes for a runner, but they'll run them into the ground.
Yeah.
And I think the problem with that one hit of beetroot is it doesn't seem to be enough, not compared to six. And if you consider six lots of half a litre of beetroot juice is putting you at about £9. Okay?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah?
Right. £9 to get the performance that you would get from that. There aren't many places you can buy £9.
£9 worth of improvements, no, is there? No.
So particularly in running. Yeah. Particularly in running, where what else can you do?
Well, funny enough, I said to him, I said, well, just try loading for those 6 days and see how you get on. And he came back and went, yeah, brilliant. Okay. He said, noticeable.
What distance?
They were doing half marathons, actually.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So, and I think they're going to be doing, is it the North Devon Marathon this weekend?
I don't know if it's this weekend. Did it clash with this? I can't remember which weekend it was.
I can't remember. But yeah.
And no, it's not this weekend. No, it's 70.3. Yeah.
That's right. Yes, it is next weekend. Yeah. And yeah, he was just like that. He said, I've done half a marathon. He said, it was a nice day anyway, but he took 5 minutes off his best time that he's done. So yeah. I said, well, I said, try it again and see how it goes. So.
Yeah. I'm working on, I haven't finalised it, working on like a fact sheet about it. Because there's, you know, there are various things that people do and various durations and types. And there's some that have done solid amounts of beetroot that's been eaten. And some where it's juice and some where it's shots. And there's different ways and there's different scenarios where it does and doesn't work. But I thought that was interesting to find that Cavendish quote. And you think, yeah, they know about it. And it's a little bit, it isn't hanging your next event on, training's been pretty pants, to be honest. My bike isn't really properly serviced and blah, 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 blah. But, oh, I've got my beetroot juice. It's like, no, it's part of, and it's almost like the icing on the cake.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's the icing on the cake and it will possibly help, but it will not dig you out of a huge hole. It will not do that.
It won't do your training for you.
No, exactly.
I was saying that you can wear as much sports kit as you want. Doesn't make you, it doesn't give you the fitness and it doesn't make you an athlete, does it? So you still got to go out and do the hard stuff that 9 times out of 10 nobody sees you doing. So.
I thought almost then we were going to get a golden nugget.
I don't want to just go straight into it, Joe.
No, because otherwise people would be knocking those t-shirts out of China before you can say Jack Robinson.
That is true, yeah.
Okay, this is a tweet about wheel weight.
Yes, that's actually quite an interesting one.
And it is from David Manning Ochran. And it says, possibly one for Crocker, ? How critical is wheel balance on lightweight racing wheels? Relatively heavy valve plus light wheel equals vibration, ? Now, here's something for you. Did you know that when they made the Envy ones, they put, like, weight in the rim to balance
opposite the valve
they
used to do it with the old tri-spokes they used to offset a little bit of the fact that your valve would have to come in between those with putting a counterweight the opposite side into the rim. A lot of manufacturers do still do it, but if for instance you're using a lightweight aluminium clincher, then what you normally find, I say normally, it's not 100%, but normally where the drilling is for the valve, opposite that is where they sleeve the aluminium rim, where they join it. So to join it, if it's a relatively good quality, they use a sleeve. So they use like a joining piece, effectively. One, to give it its strength, but two, also that little extra bit of weight offsets balance. The fact that the valve's on it. Yeah. You do get it with some of them. You do get like a bit of a wheel imbalance, but if you're running tubs, 9 times out of 10, it's because the hole that the Presto valve goes through hasn't been countersunk. So the tubular sits quite proud.
Yeah, yeah.
So, of course, you get a da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
How does it go again, the noise?
Da-da-da-da-da-da.
Right, so if you hear that noise, that's your tubular... I like that. Hanging proud.
Yeah, yeah, sorry. But a lot of the kind of the top-end guys, so people like your Envies and you know, your other deeper section kind of people, well, most of them are pre-drilled, so most of them are countersunk, so you can actually sit that tubular down a bit tighter.
Yeah.
But yes, it is a bit of a problem, but you kind of notice, yeah, with the lightweight alley stuff, it's normally the sleeve is or the join of the rim is opposite the valve hole, because you can't really drill a valve hole through a join because it'll be quite weak. Most of the top end carbon fiber stuff is almost pre-balanced, I suppose, is probably the best way.
I wondered about whether, if that's the case, whether some of these slightly chunky magnets. You know, you get those round ones, the round ones that you dial, that you twist into. Is it the tax ones or something? It's almost like serrated around the outside, and you twist it on. They're quite heavy.
Yeah.
Now, why hasn't somebody made it such that there's almost a magnet pre? You know, if the magnet was opposite the valve, you'd always have a magnet from which to get a signal for whatever speedo you needed. A bit like the frames that now include the sensors in the frame.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Integration must be obvious. And if you need a little bit more weight on the rim, a tiny, what's the name of the magnets that are really strong? A tiny neodymium, I think it is, magnet would be so small, but it would be strong enough to set off any speed sensor.
That'd be the way. I mean, I suppose without sounding corny, it's almost trying to reinvent the wheel. A mirror a week. But no, it's so to kind of answer the question, some are pre-balanced.
Yeah.
The other ones that aren't, I can honestly say I've never really noticed it. I suppose from a point of view of throw over, which is, you know, the rate at which the wheel whips round at its heaviest point, pretty much, is quite handy, I suppose. But
yeah.
With the greatest of respect, you've got so much resistance on it, I would find it difficult to be able to...
How do you notice this the most? When the bike's hanging up and you flip the wheel, and then you notice it, providing the bearings are all right, you'll notice it'll eventually settle with the hub at the bottom. So there is some weight there, and that would be escalated as velocity went up and you started noticing that moment of inertia is getting greater. You may notice that that might cause something, there's so many other bits of the bike.
Yeah, I've had guys come in and say that they get this speed wobble at a certain speed, you know, and I've known guys to
70,
85 miles an hour, but I've known guys to say that the bike shakes so violently that they thought that guys have come off on hills because of this kind of, someone called it a death wobble. Touch wood, I've never had it. But what happens is, I think people unweight themselves and get quite tense in the front, you know, holding onto the handlebars, that it starts to generate a wobble because you twitch a little bit, and then that kind of oscillates and you can't stop it.
Yeah.
Normally, by grounding yourself, so kind of sitting on the seat, touching the...
Knees on the top tube.
And then just kind of just loosening up normally makes it dissipate.
But, and sometimes it's that when people have got a lot of stack height above the...
Yes.
Above the fork... Oh, no, sorry, above the top of the frame, effectively the top of the crown. If there's a load of spacers, there's a lot of flex there, and you start to get it oscillating. And people have actually looked, if you like, the science of it, and it's quite difficult to pinpoint it. But it's often a combination of stuff that you'd notice it in the handling of the bike at low speeds. The bike, you'd say, gosh, like riding a Blancmange, the thing's like really wobbly, and it might be the back, you know, the back wheel's a little bit loose on the spoke, so you've got some oscillation there. The headset's a bit loose.
Yeah.
Person's too high on the bike. Now, I've had loads of people who've had speed wobbles because they sit too high. They don't have the saddle down. And, of course, then they're toe pointing. And it's the toe pointing that causes their leg to shake and to oscillate.
Yes,
and they can't get the weight low enough on the bike to bring it back into control. But that you've hit the nail on the head. Get the weight low and get your knees on the top tube. Yeah.
But to kind of finish off the question, then, I've never noticed a wheel to be so unbalanced that you get a shake from it.
No,
I've never noticed that. I mean, at the minute I've got a mountain bike wheel that is all over the place, you know, but I could go downhill quite happily on road, and even that wobble won't generate a feeling of it being unstable. So a lot of it is to do with the quality of wheels that you've got. If you haven't got deep section rims, then you shouldn't really be running a really long valve inner tube. It might be the only one you've got. If that's the case, then so be it.
Yeah.
But, you know, you just kind of try and...
You want just enough valve to pop out to get your pump on, but don't have these... You sometimes see people and they've got about 80 millimetres of valve, and you kind of think, that's just not right.
Yeah, and then that itself generates kind of like a throwover or an imbalance in the wheel. But as long as it's true and the bearings are good, then really the you shouldn't really need to panic too much, as long as you haven't got a massive valve in it. So, but no, it's a good question. Mm. It's a good question.
Number five. On the list anyway.
Number five.
Right, this is a tweet from Michael Henderson. And he says, Easter podcast talking about phosphate sprints. Question, seated or standing, big gear or easy gear? I kind of say, because I'll keep it short and sweet, and that way this can be one of the short and sweet answers. I think seated mostly, unless you're, you know, unless you're somebody that has to sprint in your event, i.e., you know, you are a mountain biker that has to get out of the seat and really honk it for a while, whereas most road triathletes, time trialists don't. Okay, if you're a road racer and you sprint, yes, clearly that need to. Big gear, easy gear. Well, in effect, in order to do a sprint, you don't want to be so over geared that you can't get momentum, because you'll literally be shoving it for about the first 4 seconds just to even get the thing moving. So I think you want to be, you know, at a moderate gear, so that by the time you're accelerating it, certainly over the first 4 to 6 seconds, there's something there that you're pushing on, and by the last 2 to 4 seconds, you've then got almost like thin air, but you're on top of the gear, and you're on top of a gear such that you're then tanking at possibly 25 miles an hour upwards. So it can be all of those things, but look at what you're trying to achieve. What is your event, and how do you get it wrong? You get it wrong if you do too much out the saddle in a massive gear and you're a triathlete doing Ironman distance. That's irrelevant to you. What's your thought?
No, I agree. Totally agree. Unless you're kind of training for a sprint finish like Cavendish would do, you know, there's no need to be out of the saddle, head down, backside up, sprinting for the finish line, unless that's your given thing.
Yeah.
I think you'd be better off to be seated and then just generate your power, get on top of that gear, and then that should give you anything between a 6 to 8 second sprint decent enough for you to then have to back it down and freewheel up a little bit and then carry on with your training session, and then do a couple of those, well, depending on again what you aim to achieve from the session. But the biggest thing is going at it wildly sprinting and just going, why have you done 20 sprints there? I don't know, I just thought,
also, if you're not a sprinter, it can all go horribly wrong.
Horrifically wrong.
Here's one then. Did we talk about Indurain last time, about his retirement? Yeah.
Oh.
14 years after he retired.
Yes, we did. Yes. About his figures. Yes.
Yeah. And interestingly, when you look at it, 72% of his career peak is still there when he's, 14 years after being retired. So 3/4 of what was there anyway is still there at the age of his mid to late 40s.
Yeah.
So shows how genetically endowed, without training, he's got 3/4 of what he had when he was training. So he was already, you know, it's not like he's had to carry on training to keep it there. He doesn't, you know, they don't carry on training. Yeah. So that's measure the guy, and he still gets, you know, a 450 watt ramp test, which the amount of people that I've seen in front of me do that is not many.
It's funny, only the other night I was reading some bits and bobs just from people that I follow on Twitter. And most of it is the kind of the nasty side of cycling, if you know what I mean. It's not the dark side of cycling, but a lot of naysayers. And I would like to know, actually, if they went back and tested a lot of the older guys now, it would be interesting to see what their natural ability is now. I know they're massively detrained, some of them. Mm. Some of them are still going out and tickling the pedals, but I'd love to see.
Mm. And in this case, you know, he's retired, and
I know he still does a fair bit of riding, doesn't he? He still goes out and rides his bike. It's not like he's not doing anything, but it kind of information kicks the naysayers of that era, basically, that have still kind of black marked that era.
Yeah.
It almost kicks him in the teeth to say, well, look, he's untrained, but he's putting this wattage out.
So. And it's not to say that clearly the era that we're talking about, so pre-present, and also there's still a few now based on what has happened at
the Giro.
Giro, and prior to that, you know, there are still people that are testing positive, but they're not getting a whole team, they're getting one person. And that one person straight away being told by the management, they're off contract.
Cheers
now.
Then.
Don't worry. Yeah, bye. There's your P60. Bye. And therefore, it's not like this. Oh no! He didn't do anything. And then eventually you find out the whole system was
corrupt.
Corrupt.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's got, interesting. It's interesting though.
I put a tweet out about 2% improvement on 6 weeks of uphill training. So that isn't running uphill for 6 weeks, because that'd be a heck of a hill. I'd be running Everest.
But non-stop.
Yeah, non-stop. It was a series of interval running sessions. And over 6 weeks, these people improved by 2%. A chap called Marnie sort of said, 2% in 6 weeks, not attractive as trade-offs go. And I actually said, no, in trained runners, that's 21 seconds improvement for an 18-minute 5K-er. Actually, that's a good return on investment.
Bad. Yeah.
Because most people have hit that buffer, and therefore by adding in this additional type of training over a small period, it wasn't like, you know, we'd see 2% for 6 weeks and we'd see 4% for 12 weeks and 6%, you know, 2% is a relatively doable sort of leap forwards to this slightly higher level. They probably don't maintain it forever, but for that brief period, that makes a difference.
But if you think of that 2%, for instance, you know, there's a lot of guys out there that must be just missing podiums or top three finishes by a paltry amount. And it, in their head, they've got all the equipment, they've done the training they could do. But just for a 6 week block, To squeeze that into a training program, I know is the hardest part, which is what people like yourself, you know, try and work out. But you think of some guys are losing races less than 1%,
less than 1 second. I've had recently.
yeah,
you know, somebody's missed qualification by less than one second.
That's what I mean.
So you think it all comes down to less than 1 second, but then most people perceive that they are doing everything they can do.
No, definitely.
You know, if they miss by 1 second, they say, oh, I suppose next time I better train. But if they're doing everything, they think, blimey, I was drinking my beetroot, I've got my aero bike, I've done all this, that and the other, and I missed by 1 second. Okay, so be it. But this was like taking people and adding on this type of running.
Yeah.
And maybe that is what it takes sometimes to get that additional amount. Most struggle, you know, if you've been training a while, you often struggle to get back up to where you were the previous season. You don't just, you know, do it and say, oh, this is going to be easy, I'm going to be where I am again. To get 2% improvement in 6 weeks is actually, that's the icing on the cake. Mm. It's that if you can get to a certain stage before a race and then do that final little bit and get your 2%, great, 2%. If you've never run that fast and you take 21 seconds off, you just got a PB.
Yeah.
And as PBs get harder and harder, you realise, actually, 2% is great. Give me 1% on every PB I've ever done and I'll take it, thank you very much.
I mean, I kind of think back to the amount of times I've looked back through results and just gone, well, if I was only, you know, 1%, 2% quicker over that race, you know, that leaves me, instead of getting, you know, fifth place, that leaves me, you know, second or third.
Which most of the time, it sort of goes back to the enduring thing. Most of the time when people are training, if you are training regularly, you're probably fairly close
to as good as you're going to be.
It's not like we all say, oh, do you know what, if I did 25 hours, I reckon, you know,
I'd be asleep all the time. I'd be eating and asleep.
But it's like when you've got, you know, most of the people like the Indurains, the Cavendishes, the Radcliffes and stuff, you know, they already were good. They were, you know, junior champions. Mm. They were national champions at young ages and things. So what was there was there. That was preempted by whatever they did as kids. There was something about the Brownies, you know, and even as like, you know, kids with pictures, shown pictures of them when they were really young kids, they were still going out and trying to find the steepest hills they could ride, but they were good at riding. You know, they'd already found that aptitude. Yeah. So most people, you know, you're not at the level you can be because you may well have 10 things you say, just got to get out, and every weekend I've got to make sure I ride my bike at least 2 hours, and I've got to make sure I run in my lunchtime, and da, da, da. But there's an extent to which once you're doing it regularly and somebody's clocking, you know, I don't know, 6 hours, 8 hours or something, 10 hours, whatever, if you're doing it for long enough, eventually you're going to hit your ceiling limit, okay? If you do too much, you're going to actually overreach. You're not even going to hit your ceiling, but you're going to burn out. Yeah. And I think you're often closer to your potential than you. Sometimes people aren't really honest with themselves about how much better they think they could be. You know, oh yeah, but if I really was serious, I reckon I could. No, you couldn't.
Yeah.
You know, you're not training now. It's just that you're training as best as you can. And most training effect comes from the regularity and efficiency of training. So if you're going out and you're regularly, you know, going for runs and stuff, you're not going to be that far off your ability. Because if you take fairly untrained professionals and they get back into training and they immediately are good without doing much, they're immediately head and shoulders above people. And we all knew somebody, you know, that would be at school that would immediately... I mean, we never trained for cross-country, did we? No, you just turned up and ran it. Oh, second, that's all right. And I never beat the kid that was first.
No.
Do you know what I mean? Never beat the kid that was first. And it was like, oh, that's interesting. Went to primary school, didn't do any running at primary school. You suddenly dropped into secondary school and you do cross-country and you finish second and go, oh, where did that come from? Oh, I don't know, I just did it. Do you know what I mean? And I think people are near, you know, but if you were the kid that was always last and you've never been into sport and you didn't really like doing training, it's unlikely that you're going to be in the top 10% like the ATAP. It's not to say it can't be, and I'm not setting a glass ceiling to say don't think above your level. Don't think above your station. No, be realistic about how much you are putting in. You know, and if somebody's beaten by 1 second, they think, blimey, I've done everything I could, I don't know what I could do more, then that's it.
Yeah.
But if you're not doing everything, then be honest with yourself and say, do you know what, I just don't train properly. I'm sporadic and then I go off and race everybody for 4 days and then I'll be tired and then I'll be sporadic again. And I think it's quite interesting that if you can take most of these studies where they show a 2% for this training or a 3% for this beetroot, most of it works because things are standardized and people do the same thing. And they only tweak one thing to see what happens. What they don't do is try and do this and add that and then train with that person and add this and absolutely blow themselves apart on loads of different over-stimuli.
Well, because the problem you've got is from a coach's point of view, I guess, you can correct me obviously if I'm wrong, but if you've got a standard, someone that you've been working with for a relatively long time and you tweak 3 or 4 different things and it all goes... up in the air.
That's what you were going to say.
Yeah, I know. And it all goes up in the air.
Chili hypo.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. You can't then go back and go, well, maybe it was that. Take it out. And then another season goes, that wasn't that. Yeah. Put it back in, or do you take it out, or do you leave it out? You know, if you... The whole thing for you is to be able to measure something that you've changed, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So effectively...
And something that you haven't that works.
Yes.
Which rarely are those things totally separate between people. Do you know what I mean?
That's most, right.
Most people are doing a certain thing that you say, yeah, that tends to fit. It's actually the person that does do the sporadic training that is hardest to coach. Because, it, you know, yes, you've had a great week. Wonderful. 17 hours. But it was the one where 6 hours and you were exhausted that I'm still worried about a week ago. And don't you see those two things go together?
Yeah.
17 makes you knackered. You've got to do 6 the following week. During the 17, they think, brilliant, great, look how good I am. The following week, oh, I'm really tired. And I think it is about this chip away at it. And if you chip away at it, what will happen will happen. You know, somebody that is at a certain level, you must see it with somebody that comes in to the shop, unless they suddenly find out how to ride a mountain bike like they've never known before, it's unlikely that they're going to go from, you know, 30th in their category to 3rd, literally, in 2 or 3 races.
No, that's it.
They just won't do it.
It doesn't, yeah, it doesn't
they matter. Might. They might over several seasons improve and stuff. But most of the people you talk to that are fairly good at sports, if you dig deeper, they did BMX as a kid, or they did cross country, or they, you know, they used to run with their dog every morning, but never really thought much about it, and yet they didn't realise they were training. You know, Haile Gebrselassie ran to school with his books under his arm, hence why he has a different running style on one arm than the other.
He was in my class.
I didn't know he lived in Devon.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
No, but it ran about 10k each way a day, which is just what they did, but that made him into a great runner. And you kind of look back and you think, okay, if you didn't have all of that, don't worry, because you can't change time.
That's it,
but there are people that didn't really know that they were in a... they were in like a genetic lineage that somebody was quite good, and they never knew, and they do something, they say, don't know where this come from, but I'm great at rowing, and nobody's ever rowed. And then they realise somebody did sport.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
Or that they have got certain attributes that naturally, yes, you've just got this lung capacity, or you're this tall or whatever. And it's interesting that most people are needing to be more honest with the numbers that they've got,
yeah.
And not sort of say, yeah, I did that half marathon 1:22, but I reckon it's worth a 1:19 on a flat course. Well, go to a flat course and do it, then I'll talk to you about the 1:19.
Yeah.
But don't big yourself up before you do it, because then what's the point of finding the next 2%? Because you've already set up here, oh, well, I'm quicker than what my numbers say. I think you want to be really, you never want to be unable to accept a number as that might be my best, because sometimes that is the case. And some races people go, don't know that I'll ever beat that. There must be things you've done where you think, I don't know that I'll ever beat that again. You know, that it might just be.
Yeah.
That was it.
Just get there and go, right. And it's not the reason not to try.
No.
To beat it, but sometimes everything just drops into place and you go, yep, that'll do me. And then you take it.
Yeah.
But like you said, that's Joe and myself's way of doing a yes, no kind of answer on that question.
No, we answered a multitude of questions then, and that one.
thank goodness you won a question on tyres.
This is a number, or chains. This is a question number 7. This was from Tom Phillips. And he says, I'm curious why, I'll preempt this with what the question's about. There are downloadable plans at the Vacherie Triathlon website, V-A-C-H-E-R-Y, and it's through 220 and Vacherie Tri linking up. And in there, I put about taking on board carbs, etc. And he said, I'm curious, why increase carbohydrate intake for 3 days on Tuesday in week 4? Mid-distance plan. And why I put it in there was that although 4 weeks wasn't in the last week before the race, it gets people into a habit.
Hang on, 4 weeks wasn't...
It wasn't like 4 weeks was, oh, that's the fourth week of the plan, which is race week.
Right, okay.
There were still weeks to go,
yeah,
okay?
Yeah, right, okay.
But if you have regular weeks where you taper off, and I like the 4 week cycle, that if you're doing something big, you work back on every 4 weeks. Right, yeah. Race week, right, what's the fourth week back from that? What's the fourth week back after that? And you say every fourth week, you not only get used to reducing volume, therefore you know your big weeks and you know your small week, but also you can try these things and say, okay, I've really got to see what that's like. The last thing you want to do is often try these things in race week. So, you know, get people like, back to the B troop, got people doing it before a big race to see what it's like. Do they you know, hate it, love it, easy to do? And therefore, why do it like mid plan? Well, because you've got to know what that means to be carbo loaded.
Yeah.
And if you feel that good at the end of four weeks, great, because you've got another three coming up that are going to be a little bit harder again. So it's almost like an enforced fill up the tanks.
Yeah.
It's almost saying, look, I know this would be the week where, it's recovery week, it's adaptation week, where people switch off. No, that's the week to really think about your diet, your sleep and everything else.
That's what I was going to say to you. I said, have you planned that so you can then get people's minds switching to, right, that's why I took an increase in carbohydrates, because I feel really good this week, the week after. You know, I don't feel as tired as the week before if I didn't do it. So, yeah. And plus, like you said, there's no point in then getting to the end of the block of 4 weeks before race week or before race day, where you're starting to taper off, and then you go in, oh, I've piled all this beetroot juice in my stomach, and it's turned me inside out.
Yeah,
you know, because that's all that's done then is set you on a negative kind of slope, isn't it? Where your mind's going, oh well, I haven't been very well on that. That means I'm not going to do very well. And I know for people like myself, size wise, when you start thinking, well, have I taken enough carbohydrate? I am obsessed with bonking effectively.
Just rephrase it.
Do you know what? I just looked at your blank look there. I'm obsessed with running out of energy when I exercise or race. Yes.
Bonking, hitting the wall.
Hitting the wall, yeah.
What's the other one?
I've got a couple.
Getting the knock.
Yeah. So the knock, effectively, I am obsessed with that. That is one of my biggest fears. And there's not many things I fear, but doing all that training and then get into that race where you go, I feel all right. And then all of a sudden, because you've just neglected that tiny little bit of it, you've just turned around and gone, oh no, what have I done? And you know exactly what you've done by the time it hits you, but it's too late.
It was good, and it was after this, so it was quite timely. There'd been some research done on marathon times and trying to predict outcomes and what was the most likely thing to have a positive effect. And the almost the highest rated effector of the marathon time was their diet in the last, I think it was 24 to 36 hours.
Yeah.
So the diet at that point made the biggest difference to their overall performance. And therefore, carbo loading is an absolute essential part of something. And that was a marathon, which is in the, let's say, 3-4 hour range for most people doing
it. Yeah.
Okay. There are people doing it 4 to 5, I understand. Well, this is a half Ironman. So this is at least 4 to 5 and more likely 5 to 6+ hours. So carbo loading is even more important. And I think it's kind of, people just assume, oh yeah, I'm on carbs. And they don't realise if you properly carbo load, you're pretty sick of the stuff by the end of the week. You've upped your carb intake, your training's been dropping. You don't just kind of eat a normal diet that is way by normal I mean a normal person's diet. So you've cut back to just not much food and said, oh well, yeah, but I'm not training much, and therefore somehow that's going to make you carbo load. No, you need to maintain a relatively high intake of carbohydrate, even though it might be above what you need. That's fine. You are in the taper. The whole point of the taper for something that takes 5 hours is you want to be filling the tanks.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you get used to that and try it 4 weeks out, even 8 weeks out, you go, wow, yeah, on that Sunday, and by the time I went to, you know, train also on the Monday, God, I felt heavy at first, but wow, I really felt full of energy.
Yeah.
There you go. That's proper carbo loading.
But then that's the thing with the question there is again, it's you're leaving that thing to chance, aren't you? Again, it's all the guesswork. So that's why you've got to try these things in your training. If it doesn't agree with you, then fine. You can find another way to go at it.
But you can't ignore that, because carbohydrate is the fundamental difference between whether you can go fast or slow. Is whether you have, not whether you've got willpower, because willpower will take you to a certain point. If glycogen runs out, no matter what you think you can do,
that's it.
You absolutely cannot push yourself when glycogen is going ever lower. So that's what happens with the knock. You think for a while, yeah, I'll push it, and eventually you realize there is nothing there.
Can't go anymore.
Can't go any there. And if you look at it in real time, you can't eat yourself out of that hole. It's too late.
Yeah.
You can get yourself moving and you can work at, you know, a modest intensity, but you certainly can't be on, you know, mid-zone 2 and upwards in terms of proper race pace for most disciplines. You just haven't got it there. You cannot get enough carbohydrate calories through the system in order to do that.
Yeah.
You might take a whack of, I've never seen it, whether people take a real whack of caffeine and carbohydrate, but one study just published looked at, we know caffeine makes people work harder. Well, what about if they're on low glycogen? And they found that people that are on low glycogen days, deliberately trying to stimulate their muscles by effectively depleting their muscles and then doing an interval session, the caffeine made a better kind of use of their resources.
Yeah.
It still didn't get them out of the hole, but they could still do relatively good quality, better than if they were not caffeinated and also glycogen depleted.
Oh, right,
so when people are tired, and I'm thinking, you know, overreach weeks, training camps, or maybe when you hit the wall and think, but I've still got to do as much work as possible, that's when caffeine comes in. And that might be where people notice it with caffeine gels and Ironmans and Coca-Cola, is that they take it and it does give them this additional neural ability to push hard, even though technically they're still not pushing that hard because they haven't got the glycogen there.
Yeah. So the answer to the question is
yeah,
trying it. Yes. Yes, please, yes. Twice. The reason for the inclusion of that
is test it.
It's testing. Yes.
Test it. Try everything several times in training.
Yeah.
Test it. That's the acronym of TESTIT. Try everything several times in training.
Now you tell me about t-shirts, Joseph. That's a wife beater right there. Oh, sorry, a sleeveless t-shirt. Sorry.
Yes. Correct terminology. There we go. There's a question.
Now, you always, you 9 times out of 10, no, stitch me up.
I'm
with not stitching
you up. I'm just giving you one, because otherwise it's bizarre talking in second person about yourself.
This is from Dave Sweeney.
Yeah. And it was a general email, but he's since agreed that it's all right to use it in the podcast.
Okay. It says, "Hi, Joe. Last year in Try 220, you said to take creatine after a gym session. I think it was 2 milligrams. Could I take 2 milligrams every day, as I feel like I've plateaued and need a little kick? Training 12 to 15 hours a week. Any help much appreciated. Thanks, Dave."
So firstly, let's get it right. It's grams, not milligrams. Okay, it's grams. Okay. And you read it right. He's put milligrams,
okay,
but it's grams.
Yeah.
And the European Food Standards Agency has said that they, because they're now people giving the okay for supplement, you know, labelling and so forth.
Okay.
They say what's given the okay. They say 3 grams, and most sports scientists have already said 2 to 5 grams is the amount that you need with carbohydrate at the same time to make a significant effect in the muscle.
Okay, yes.
Okay, so yeah, Dave, you need, and I did email him back and say, yes, you need to have, most people talk about 3 to 5 grams in possibly something like a recovery drink after weights or just in a sports drink. You don't leave it hanging around in the drinks. You don't mix it, drive to the gym and so forth. Creatine does degrade to creatinine. So you want it, really, get recovery powder, put a teaspoonful of creatine in it, and then towards the end of the session or straight afterwards, mix water in, shake it, and drink it straight away.
Just to give the guys a head up with what creatine is and why would you take it?
Okay, so the majority of creatine in the body is in muscle. It is, yep, just like your huge biceps, Martin, that you're giving everybody a, you know, we could always put a picture of your bicep, but that could drop the numbers pretty rapidly.
Tic-tac looks big strapped to a matchstick, apparently, so I've been told.
So the supplement form is creatine monohydrate. No other version has been tested and has been given the thumbs up. There's been various creatine citrate, creatine, all manner of versions. But creatine monohydrate with around 20 grams or more of carbohydrate or recovery drink, that pushes the insulin up. The creatine then can enter the muscle cells, and the creatine is... it sort of eventually becomes part of the creatine phosphate part of the muscle. So basically the chain of events that really causes the muscle itself to contract. So it's at a much higher level than things like carbohydrate and fat that you've got in your body that provide energy to cause that conversion.
Yeah.
Creatine phosphate, which is the one of the final sort of areas that creatine becomes stored in the muscle, that's an actual breakage link. As it breaks, it makes energy. The energy allows the muscle fibers to contract. So it's at a high level, but every process still goes through creatine. I know there's much research that shows that it helps people that do strength work, sprint work, but it does seem to help people that do endurance work as well. It does seem to make the muscle more fatigue resistant. It's not categorical, but if you have low creatine levels in your muscle, it may work that for some people that are even, you know, this person's endurance, they're not doing 10 to, you know, 12 to 15 hours of weight training. They're an endurance athlete. I think he was working towards one of the Ironman races. It may be that because most creatine's got through meat, people don't eat enough meat to get it, that actually a small, maybe 2-3 times a week of getting creatine in with recovery drinks can actually keep your muscle stores not pumped up like a bodybuilder, but just keep the muscle functioning at an energy level more efficiently. Because all of this carbohydrate, fat going through the system and trying to make the muscles actually work all has to eventually comes down to the creatine phosphate breakage.
Okay.
So more creatine can make some people, particularly veggies, can make them feel a lot stronger and actually be more fatigue resistant. So it isn't just, I know there's people that argue, oh, it might increase people's body weight and there's no categorical evidence that it helps endurance athletes. No, but there are some endurance athletes low meat eaters, or their body doesn't synthesize creatine very well, that have absolutely said, look, I took that and I got way stronger. I'm a kilo heavier, but I'm strong enough to overcome that kilo, and I can train better.
So with reference to today's question, could I take two grams, sorry, every day, as I feel like I've plateaued and need a little kick? So with reference from using the creatine for Dave here, are we saying that a little bit more creatine might give him the kick that he needs? Is that what you're saying? Or?
Well, no, I mean, it's got to get the dose right, and I don't think he is putting 2 milligrams in, because that would basically be, you know, it would hardly be a couple of specks of the stuff. So he probably is using 2 to 5 grams. Yeah. But I said, look, make sure you're using the carbohydrate or carbohydrate and protein to make sure that at the same time as you take it, you can spike insulin and get more of it into the muscle. How many times, you know, he might need it, I don't know that it would, you know, automatically give a spark. It depends on how much he has been doing.
Yeah, yeah.
If he's been taking, you know, a very small amount, literally putting a gram in to water and just drinking it randomly at any part of the day, he wouldn't get anything. If he put 5 grams in with a recovery drink and took it after hard sessions, he will notice whatever effect he may get.
Yes,
some people do respond to it very positively because they have low creatine. We're not all equal. When you measure people's creatine levels, and some of the research in the mid-90s actually published the individual levels of all these athletes, and it was all over the shop. There was lots of people, and the people that had the least creatine to start with were the ones that responded the best to the supplement. So it is one of those suck it and see supplements. Cool. Not that, again, we're trying to get everybody to buy stuff and base it on the placebo, but there just are people that say, wow, I don't ever eat red meat. I take that 2 times a week when I'm training hard, and I can feel the difference. It's like, great. Don't worry. Don't think that every action in life has to have 100 papers peer-reviewed that tell you that you can do that action.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Sometimes, and I would say quite a lot of times, especially with training and nutrition, less so with technology, but training and nutrition, there are people already doing stuff that only now sports science is saying, do you know what? We understand what's going on there, you know? And I think creatine is one of those ones that, you know, you might respond. If you do, you'll know it. If you don't, okay, that's 10 quid invested in something that didn't quite respond. But it's not harmful. It's EFSA approved. It's easy to integrate into existing stuff. And if you do respond, you might bring your stores back up to an even keel with somebody that's already got higher levels.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can argue it's bringing people up to an even keel. It's not, you can't go over what your body will absorb.
It is
a set level. But if you've got it below par, you can bring it up to the level.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I've got our star question. Star question.
Here we go.
From Tim Amos. And I put star question, free power bar goodies. So Tim, when you listen to this, email us your address and I'll send you some free power goodies. Now, not those two gels. You've had your horrible mitts on. You've had your grubby little mitts all over those. You haven't eaten them. You can't give him two like empty wrappers and say,
well, they're nice.
Hi, Joe and Crocker. Question on stretching. I'm new to triathlon, having decided to take it up for a challenge since finding out I had a heart condition at the age of 26. Two ops later, I'm 100% fit for a given value of fit and have been getting down to some serious training. I come from a cycling background, swimming and running are new to me, and it's running that's probably unsurprising, causing me the most grief. I read a lot of contradictory advice about stretching and mobility and wonder where you stand on this and how it can be best worked into a training programme. I have about 8 hours to train, and come September we'll be commuting on bike from Bath to Bristol, so we'll be getting some stealth training in here too. Any advice you can give would be much appreciated. Love the podcast. Yourself and Martin make a great double act, and you present sometimes quite complex ideas in a really accessible and amusing manner. You're the amusing, yes. Thank you for pointing it.
Simple
yourself.
Funny man.
Simple funny man in the corner. Simple monkey funny man. Keep up the good work. Best regards, Tim. When he says he's commuted by bike from Bath to Bristol, I presume he goes from Bristol back to Bath.
Yeah, that's actually a nice commute.
It's brilliant, along the cycle track.
Yeah.
Perfect. You've got a very lucky... I've actually done that a few times, Tim, when I used to live there. Used to go backwards and forwards to Bristol. Lovely cycle track. Used by a lot of people.
Yeah.
Don't ride up and down the A4. Just keep to the cycle track. You can keep your wits about you by listening to podcasts like this. So what do you reckon then? Let's give you your 10 penneth. And we've got less than 2 hours, so keep it sweet.
Well, actually, I'm going to... Can I let you answer it first?
Okay.
Because so, I think I know...
And you want me to tell you?
I think I know what you're going to say. Personally, but...
Personally. Okay, so you've got 8 hours to train, so that's good. So you're doing triathlons, you should split it up, you know, probably a... depending, if you're going to be getting in your commuting to Bath and Bristol, the last thing you have to worry about is too much time training on your bike. You might find that, you know, you take one day off in the week not to commute so that you give your legs a rest. If you commute all the time, you won't have the legs to do quality sessions. Even if you cycle backwards, it's sometimes nice when people don't commute. Cycle backwards, I mean, to and from work. When people... constantly commute, they don't realize sometimes how tired they can be.
Yeah, you know, that's the thing. Especially if for a week you do it, isn't it, and Friday you're like that.
Yeah, not only that, if you have to do it into a gale and it happens to be in both directions and so on. So you've probably got enough time to balance all these things around. And you say, you know, how it can be worked into a training program. I mean stretching and mobility is a factor. You said you found a heart condition at 26, two ops later, so I must imagine you're late 20s, possibly into early 30s. You're there or thereabouts. So you're not, you know, you're not old. The level of flexibility and mobility of your muscles won't be awful. You're not starting exercise at 60 saying, "Oh, my muscles don't seem to...
a bit
stiff sometimes after 20-mile runs." Oh, really? So... I think you can do stretch and mobility after your training, okay? Sometimes as a cool down, but it should be done within a reasonable range of motion of what you need. You don't have to try and get your nose onto your groin and be as flexible as a gymnast.
Yeah.
You know, you just sit and reach. You should be able to sit and reach and roughly touch your toes or thereabouts. Interestingly, Porter Radcliffe, when she started a marathon running, could reach further than when she was at a peak where she couldn't quite reach. And I think it dropped back something like 5 centimetres off the top of my head. I can find out the exact number, but a sit and reach reduced slightly, but it was reasonable. It was still already there. It wasn't like she could only get her hands to her knees and said, "Oh, I can't reach. I can't do a sit and reach and touch my toes, or that's impossible." So I think do some of it, but try to identify what things do you need to stretch, because general mobility isn't a limiting factor for most people. However, if you have incredibly tight upper body muscles from, I don't know, playing rugby or never really having used your upper body for swimming, you might need to get massage, get shown how to do stretching, and to make sure that you make your body efficiently move, because it's all about efficient movement. Okay, if you can bend over on a bike even to a reasonable level and your back isn't killing you, you can ride a bike.
Yeah.
If you're excessively immobile, you might find you have to work on it. You might do things like in the off season you might do classes in Pilates, yoga, things like that. But don't try and be the most flexible person that you know. You only have to be flexible enough. Too flexible, particularly in running, is more injury prone.
Yeah.
Cycling, you need to be moderately flexible through the lower back, glutes, hamstrings, but you don't have to be, again, excessively flexible. It helps to be slightly more flexible than you need, but you don't need a lot. On the flip side of that, you do need to make sure that your particular sort of weak links need to be the things that you don't ignore.
Yeah.
So if you do have, I just got these really tight hamstrings. Well, get something done on that. That isn't going to go away just by sitting in the bath and touching your toes three times at the end of every run. You need to work on it as part of something that's ongoing, but don't see it as a component that's got to take up 3 of your 8 hours.
That's right.
It's literally take up, 10 minutes at the end of each session, and maybe in the off season you devote a session that would have been, a 1 hour outdoor session, say, I'm going to go to Pilates or yoga, or Pilates, then yoga. And that's going to be my night of giving my body kind of mobility and strength work in a completely different way that will help it adjust to being more flexible than just being able to put my hands above my head so I can swim, being able to just about reach the handlebars so I can bike and shuffle along when I'm running. And I know there are people that really focus on flexibility, but for most people, it's not your key limiting factor.
Yeah.
It'll actually be about you being able to balance the swimming, biking, running, and keeping it at a moderate level where you chip away. We were only talking earlier about you chip away at this process of improving. You don't try and say, I'm really going to go for it now, and break yourself at a faster rate than your body could adapt. Mm. It will adapt on a small handful of percentage points every 6 to 12 months. It's not going to be that you're going to get 10% quicker every 6 months, year on year. You'll make little progress. So the things that you like doing, like stretching and mobility, if you like it and it gives you a Wednesday night thing to do, and that's a day when you don't commute and you take the bus or somebody's car, whatever, and don't take their car, you go with the car with them.
With content.
And then you go and do your Pilates, great. Do that as an off season. It'll be something that's contributing to your flexibility, but isn't trying to make you, overly flexible. Sorry, we've just had a heck of a rainstorm suddenly hit the office there. Wow, that's amazing. So what were you going to say, Martin?
I thought you would have been a little bit harsher on it personally, but I feel benefits from stretching.
Yeah.
But like you said, I think prevention is obviously better than cure when you come to injuries. So
yeah.
What amazes me sometimes is when people have done a run or have been running, the next day, I'm really stiff, I'll do some stretching tonight. It's not going to get rid of your muscle stiffness.
No.
If anything, a stiff cold muscle stretched, you're running a bigger risk of an injury there.
Yeah. Or what you do is you further encourage the muscle to keep itself taut by the fact you're trying to, it should always be warm.
Yeah.
The muscle should be warm, and therefore there will be cases where you just got muscle damage or soreness that's a result of what you've done, and stretching doesn't
get rid of that.
I mean, it might. I saw something recently that they think that it might reduce some of the perceived soreness that people have, but it doesn't get rid of it. DOMS, or delayed onset muscle soreness, happens when you run hard, when you've done a hard effort on the bike and you've been bent over, for an hour flat out, or when you've been mountain biking. You just say, that's damage. But if I listen to that, then I don't train hard, because that's my body saying, look, you're beat up.
Yeah.
Don't try and do too much. And stretching won't allow that to bounce back. It really won't. There's never been that case of saying, oh yes, the people that stretched are able to train the next day after a marathon. No, not the case.
No.
What you can do, if the muscle is particularly damaged, is you can make it worse by stretching it when it's in a damaged state.
Yeah. And I think sometimes, like you said, you don't sacrifice the fact that you're giving up maybe 2 of your precious hours where you could be doing a little bit more training, or you could be resting, just to go and do a 2-hour stretching session. At the end of the day, your stretching is something you can add to. I think sometimes mentally it helps people out, where they can just stop and focus and concentrate on how they feel, how a particular muscle group feels. And like you said, if you find that you've got tight hamstrings, kind of stretching them out and then going, oh no, still hasn't solved it. Then going, well, I'll do it again tomorrow. Oh, it still hasn't solved it. Just kind of stretching and stretching and expecting it to go away just doesn't normally happen. So, get yourself a massage or get it looked at and then move on from there. But I think, yeah, a bit of time can be dedicated to it in the off season, like you said, if you wanted to do Pilates or something like that, then brilliant. But personally, I dedicate a bit of time to it, and I do find that it does help with certain things, you know, like lower backs and hamstrings and hip flexors, things like that, then yeah, it does.
I think there's a need for often people just being aware of their body, and if they need, you know, you cannot just stretch out all the problems. Sometimes you need to give the body more rest, or you need to realize the reason why it's so sore is that you failed to feed it right, and therefore you spent the last quarter of a session fighting the muscles because they were working wrong.
Yeah.
And therefore you get muscle soreness the next day because your muscles have worked in a different way. Or it is muscle damage from a hard run. Well, that's telling you don't do it. That should be the next day to swim.
Yeah.
Rarely is actual flexibility the reason why somebody can't perform.
That's it. That's the biggest thing, isn't it? Yeah. I think people then immediately, if you can fold yourself in half, either down to your toes or bend over backwards, people must be a good athlete then. Must be a good athlete. Like that. Well, yeah, they're flexible, but doesn't it's not a limiting factor, is it, on your performance, whether you can touch your toes or not.
Yeah. I mean, so, I know sometimes people have, you know, they have tight hamstrings, and sometimes that's because, you know, they finish runs and stop, and they never slow down gradually. They don't afterwards just take the muscle into a range of or length of movement that still is held for around 30 seconds, so the muscle actually gets to feel and then relax at that length. But even that, you don't want to do that excessive and be doing it, and it's sometimes cooling the muscle or keeping it warm afterwards. That's so you protect it and go, look, that is a muscle that if I just go out, run really hard, stop, get in my car and drive for 2 hours, you're not going to have very good hamstrings at the end of that. So it's the management of it. And lots of people think the training is doing the hamstrings in, and they sit in the car for 8 hours, you know, several times a week. That's the factor, because that's a bent knee pushing the accelerator up and down, or the clutch if they're in a manual, and that's what causes it, not the running they're doing. So I think, do it, Tim. Make sure you put some time aside at the end of sessions to allow you to cool down and to do it. Some people, it is, you know, time efficiency. They sit in the bath and they just reach their toes and hold it for a count of 30 and then sit back up and, you know, then do it again. Just go, I'll just do a little bit. I don't need to do too much. I'll make sure I stretch my quads. I'll do my calves and be aware of it, but don't go down the road of thinking you've got to do loads of it. Because if you take it too far, you could actually stretch the muscle to be weaker, but also to take time out that isn't actually, you know, time you've got to take out.
Yeah.
It's your stamina, your strength, your stamina, your strength, your skill, and your speed ability. All of those are far bigger than suppleness.
Then whether you can touch your toes or not.
Yeah, and there are plenty of people that are very flexible and they work on that, but they can sometimes not therefore put their muscles under. They're kind of like flexible, loose muscles. Like, no, sometimes your muscles need to hurt.
Yeah.
And sometimes they do need to be sore, and sometimes they do need to be functional for what you have to do. And outside of that sport, feel a little bit like, oh yeah, but, or I can feel that when I'm running, that my quads have got used to biking. Well, yeah, that's it. If you want to stay loosey-goosey and never have hard muscles, that's the walkers, tai chi, Pilates people that, you know, like to do activity and stuff but don't like to put their body under huge stress.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're doing triathlon, you've got to manage the three sports and look at it, you know, if you're doing the sport at the moment, is flexibility limiting you? And it could be, and if it is, get something done on it, but don't only do your own stretching, also look at sports massage and get somebody to loosen off and encourage you to be aware of how your muscles are tight and what signals you should be listening out to not damage a muscle and then make it permanently that you've got this bit on your hamstring that makes you run funny and that then affects your other leg and so on.
And a decent sports masseur will be the kind of person that you go to when you haven't got an injury. You just want a massage, and they'll say, brilliant. Well, when do I need to come see you again? Whenever you feel you need to. So that's it. So you shouldn't have to go repetitively unless you've had an injury, you know, 7 or 8 times just to get this one thing looked at. So
okay, right, we've got a bundle of research and I'm going to do them. I know, Martin, you love that. Look at this, look at this.
You're like a man possessed.
I am, yes. No, just some sort of quick updates. Recent bit of research in the Journal of Sports Sciences on shoe cleat position during cycling and its effect on running performance in triathletes. So can you move the cleat around and it affect running speed? No, don't worry about it. It doesn't. There we go. That's that bit of paper.
Recycle bin.
Next one. Beta alanine. So the supplement beta alanine.
He's a nice chap.
And its effect on cycling performance in highly trained cyclists. Bottom line, 4 weeks of beta alanine made a worthwhile change in time trial performance. There we go. Job done. So there might be something in that one.
Next,
please. This was interesting. Foot bone marrow edema after 10 weeks transition to minimalist running shoe. So actually looking at the foot and when people put minimalist running shoes on what actually happened. And you don't get a lot of this. People talk a lot about, you know, barefoot running and wearing...
When you said interesting, I was like, oh, God, here we go. But carry on, sorry.
Carry on. And they used 36 experienced recreational runners. They had MRIs before and after this 10 weeks. Some were in a controlled group that were in normal shoes and others gradually transitioned to a Vibram 5-finger running shoe. Okay. And then the severity of the bone marrow edema was scored on a 0 to 4, etc. Pre-training, there was no difference in the groups. The post-training MRI scores showed that more subjects in the Vibram group, 10 out of the 19, showed increases in bone marrow edema in at least one bone after 10 weeks of running.
Okay.
So they said runners interested in transitioning to minimalist running shoes, such as Vibram, should transition very slowly and gradually in order to avoid potential stress injury on the foot. And this was over 10 weeks that they transitioned.
Explain an edema.
Okay, this can be, and I'll use their exact terminology, it's a manifestation that added stress on the foot, okay? You get this kind of like swelling effect with certain parts of the foot, and particularly, I don't know the specifics of what happens with bone marrow edema, but you're looking at something where physically you bash into the floor, and you do break down not only red blood cells underfoot, quite literally by damaging them underfoot, but you do affect the foot, and people haven't really looked at that. And you know, the added stress of having less cushioning could be worse. Right. Okay, we, you know, well, I don't know about you, but you used to running tiny little plimsolls when you ran cross country at school, and some of that was on, you know, on tarmac, wasn't it? You didn't run in.
Unfortunately, Joseph, I'm not as old as you, and I mean that in the nicest way, believe me. But yes, I 9 times out of 10 we had some relatively well, whatever my parents could afford. But I would say yes. I suppose I used to have a relatively poor pair of trainers, but. I think this kind of research is relatively good, and on the flip side, probably, I don't know, I think it's relatively good to show that, you know, do we need all these fancy cushion trainers, but is it a bit of a ploy just to sell us some more gimmicks? But personally, I think if the cushioning protects you and is able to make your feet last longer. I know that sounds awful.
Yeah.
But I think that's you know, it's a good thing. So
yeah, and it's relatively new research, and you know, there's a lot of assumptions. Oh, it must be really good. It makes people really efficient. And this is 10 weeks, and it's a slow process. And even so, you know, over half of them got, you know, something in at least one bone. They say at least one bone. I haven't looked into the full data. I just wanted to present like the kind of headline bit to it. And I, you know, I've seen people running on these things just exclusively, and you think, no, that's not right. You know, particularly if you're running on hard surfaces like tarmac and concrete paving stones that make up, you know, many sort of pavements in, you know, built up areas. That stuff's too hard on you. That isn't what was invented 20,000 years ago when we used to roam around in the trees and the so on. We used to run on sand and soil. And if you are of the, you know, inner city runner type that runs on hard surfaces, don't try and do it in the minimalist shoes. That doesn't make sense. Look at elite runners. They might do some barefoot running, and barefoot running was not kind of made popular, but a guy who grew up in this area, now a veteran runner, really started people talking about this idea of running on sand.
Yeah.
And it had been kind of talked about and people did it, but now we're on about the other way. We're on about people wearing the minimalist of shoes, running on concrete and tarmac.
Running on hard stuff,
yeah. Now, they don't say where these people ran, and that must be a conflicting factor. The harder the surface, the more you want a shoe. You don't want an extreme shoe, just enough shoe there. But yeah. Interesting that they've got data on it to say, look, don't jump onto these things.
Yeah,
that was 10 weeks, and there were still half of them had issues. It didn't say to what severity that actually meant that they were technically, you know, causing themselves real damage, but there was still something there that they didn't seem to be exactly happy with. And I think if I look at the... let me just grab the data. I've suitably filed it. I think they said that... But they don't say, you know, they're not statistically different between the groups, but they don't say that there was any increases in the control group. So they didn't have any effects, whereas the ones with the minimalist shoes did. Anyway, that's that. That's that.
I like that.
If you wear minimalist shoes, take a long time to get used to them. Hmm. And this was this study I was on about earlier. Caffeine, when you've got low or normal glycogen stores. So does caffeine help? And when you're at that classic 3 milligrams per kilogram level. So for most people we're talking about 150 to potentially as much as 250 milligrams. Doing 8x5 minute high intensity training, actually the caffeine increased power output when they were on low glycogen, increased it by 3.5%. So it did help.
But how long was that for, sorry?
That was eight by five minute bouts of high intensity. So it said it enhances the power output independent of the glycogen, but it still couldn't fully restore the output to their normal glycogen level training. So if you're on low glycogen, you can still get a better session out, but you're not going to be as good as if you say, oh, I train on low glycogen, I'll just take loads of caffeine to get me back up to normal. No, you won't. They did sort of say that it further enhances the training response that low muscle glycogen might give. There's this idea of training low. I train low glycogen by doing high intensity work when you're in a low glycogen state. But it's still not known how productive that is and how counterproductive it is to be trying to work hard when your legs are just
empty.
You've
got nothing,
Another caffeine one about caffeine withdrawal, about if people have a sort of a habit of taking caffeine, does it help if they withdraw from it and then load up?
You get a bigger hit, is that?
Yeah,
the kind of thing?
And
yeah.
No, basically. So if you like your caffeine, just keep on your caffeine. Don't think you have to come off it for a while. I found another one on caffeine as well.
Absolutely.
Do you like the filing cabinet?
I like what you've done there.
3 milligrams per kilogram. They doubled them up to 6 milligrams per kilogram. Okay, this was a group headed by Ben Desbro in Australia, and
they just let them loose in the outback, just let them go.
And there was, it did not give additional improvements in performance. It, you know, 6 milligrams per kilogram, 6 sevens are 42, so that's like almost 500 milligrams a kilo of caffeine for me. That's half a gram of caffeine. I mean, you'd be bouncing off the chair, let alone doing any cycling. And it actually wasn't as good, but it wasn't statistically significant. But it doesn't make sense to go up and up and up and up and say, oh, I've taken this much, I'll take more. 3 milligrams per kilogram is enough. And to that effect, on the JBST website or coachjoebeer.com, whichever way you use it, the top right, there's an updated caffeine loading fact sheet just about caffeine, how to do it, its background, the fact that it is a turbo and how it works. So that's up there for you to
have.
And overall, I just wanted to leave, excuse me, one last one.
Just want to leave you with one last thing. I thought you were going to break into song.
Aerodynamics of running socks. I knew that would make you laugh. I know it made you laugh. Aerodynamics of running socks. So it's this idea that some socks have been sort of said to be, you know, make you run faster by the fact that they're aerodynamic. And when you're moving at speed, they're going to make a difference. And this was tested. They stretched socks over tubes that represented leg size, and they measured the drag and this, that and the other, and they worked it all out.
And how did they get on, Jack?
How did they get on? Well, even up to speeds of
55 miles an hour.
I think it was more than 40. I think it was 50 meters per second.
50 meters per second?
Per second, yes. And how fast is that? 12 to 13 metres per second is 27 miles an hour. So that's something like 80 to 100 miles an hour. I didn't work it out exactly, but it's that fast. Even across that spread, there was no significant difference between the sock that they tested. And they tested one called Nike Dry Fit. They tested various other types of socks, different sort of materials, but all trying to be, you know, aerodynamic. Or
how do these people get money for this funding for this kind of research?
Yes,
I know where it comes from. I can take a rough guess where it probably comes from, but
I don't know. Normally it tells you at the end of this whether they had any funding from it, but often it's not that complicated a test to do different socks and to look into the science of it. And they did quote about the Jabulani ball that Adidas designed that was meant to have been kicked better in the 2010 World Cup, was it? Something like that. And all the various things that swimsuits, you know, Adidas had their swimsuit made in a flume. And they were saying, do these socks actually, you know, they're called aerodynamically designed, but they're not actually aerodynamic. The principle of how they're made and the grooves and stuff makes sense from an aerodynamic perspective.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you could say it's designed with aerodynamics in mind, but there's just nothing in it. So I was thinking, well, when you look at a cyclist, there are people wearing aerodynamic socks, and they haven't done specific aerodynamic socks, because you see people now with calf guards and stuff in triathlons and time trialists. Is there something in that, and would it be different because they would be much more of a lycra-based, whereas these weren't? But, you know, they couldn't find anything, and they just sort of said, well, you know, there's no real reason, because the results demonstrated there's no significant differences between the sock properties of 12 sock tested. But the sock may be engineered to help the person go faster by reducing drag. But unfortunately, that doesn't actually measure up to scrutiny. So when people start talking about aerodynamic socks, particularly for running, like, how fast do you think you're running?
Outrageous.
Outrageous. I just thought it was funny, you know, the aerodynamics of running socks, and you think, blimey, that's really starting to stretch.
Well, that's the thing. I suppose every little quarter has got to be looked at, but personally, I think that's probably not the way to go.
No. And have you got any final little golden nugget gems?
No, I think I'm done.
You're done, are you?
So,
oh, right.
But there were some really good questions there, actually.
There were, yeah. There was a good lot of questions. I was going to take a picture of all the bits of paper that we threw on the floor, but I think that's highly unprofessional, because I took a picture of all the notes we made, and then I was going to take a picture of the filing this morning, but no, that's all right. What?
Nothing.
I thought you had a point to say there.
No.
Okay,
not at all.
Yeah, good questions. Thank you very much. Thank you, Crocker.
Anytime.
Invaluable input, absolutely. We'll start the t-shirts off. We've already got one person that wants to buy one. Oh, you think I'm joking, don't you?
No,
I'm not. Thank you, listeners. Content, your support, your reviews. Thank you. It's really, really nice to get feedback for people to say thank you. That really did work.
Good.
Can't coach everybody. Don't have the time, but it's quite nice to put stuff out there and think, if people do this, or if this gets them thinking about something, let's help them. Let's help them definitely. Do something a bit better. And also, I was going to say, not that they'll probably hear it, but thank you to the companies who helped me do what I do and helped me to kind of be able to do this as a career and be able to enjoy looking at endurance sports and nutrition and technology and stuff like that. Because you're in the heart of it, aren't you, Croc? I mean, what is it like? It's the hub.
There's quite a lot of paper and quite a lot of books. So, yeah, it is interesting considering that, you know, we try and do this every month, don't we? We come into the office and there's me forever going, what's that there? And you going, oh, well, this is a book from 1980 whatever, or a little a French cycling magazine. Why have you got that there? And then you kind of opening it up and letting us have a butcher's. So, yeah, there's a little box in the corner which has me slightly nervous with the keys hanging out of it.
The what?
That little box there.
This?
Yeah.
Oh, that's the petty cash box.
Sweet Lord. It just has me worried.
You thought that was, something I was holding for somebody, like, you know, security.
Security. No, it's, it is fascinating. And plus, I know with the time that we are in now season-wise, a lot of guys have done quite a bit of racing already.
It's happening. You know, like we say, Wimbledon this weekend, there's been Mallorca 70.3, there's been plenty of Ironmans and road races and time trials, and it is, you know, literally every weekend is a bundle of text and stuff that happen that people are racing. It's like, great, because this is the here and now. If you're going to do something, just get into it now. Don't wait. You know, the season will be past and we'll be sitting here going, oh crikey, what are you going to do for winter? Yeah.
Look at the snow. So it's me going into the abyss of winter again. But for all the guys that are doing Wimbledon this weekend, I'm so sorry about the weather.
we won't get this out before weekend.
But anyway, so for all those guys that have done it, I'm so sorry the weather was bad. Yeah.
We could see it coming.
Yeah.
So please contact us with your questions. Click contact at coachdobeer.com or tweet us or add stuff to the Facebook page. Newsletter, sign up. It'll be coming very soon. And watch the Twitter feed for tips, time savers, athlete achievements and stuff like that between the podcasts. Train smart, have fun, and we'll be sending out another one of these in about a month's time.
All the best.
Test
2. 2-1-2.
Yeah, don't do it too late. Right, is this... Mine's not registering.
Yeah, it is.
Is it?
Yeah.
But not as much?
Well, no, it's only because I've been about an inch away from
it. Okay, so talk at normal level. Let's just have a look. So if I'm going to sit like this, does yours pick up?
I don't know, I can't help but lean in and talk into it. I can't stop it.